the show that goes there. This is the Shaggy Jenkins Show on the Pacifica Radio Network.
It's the Shaggy Chicken Show on the Pacifica Radio Network. Welcome to it. Now, today, I have given the correspondents a break as we are going to talk a little bit about journalistic responsibility. God help us all. I'll also try to cover a little bit of some of the latest turmoil out of D.C., but mostly today, we'll be focusing on one important question that nobody has decided to ask yet. That question? How do we heal after this is all said and done? Well, before we get to all of that, some brief introductions are in line. Hi, I am your host. My name is Shaggy Jenkins. I'm a critical thinker, problem solver, guy just left of normal and sane, and always centered in common sense, and found on my website, shaggyjenkins.com, or wherever fine social media is trolled at Shaggy Live. Now, before we begin with all of the news stories, I would kind of like to have a discussion because time and time again over the weekend, especially after it was revealed that Bob Barr and everybody had received Mueller's special report and put out a four-page summary, watching the news has been difficult at best. And reading the news has been difficult at best. I don't even want to go into radio news because, well, that's my foray. But this is the thing. A lot of people kind of assumed that Mueller's investigation would lead us to an absolute conclusion that, boom, bam, conclusions, done, we have something, let's move on as a country. But unfortunately, that's not how this situation works. And it really got me thinking with all the bitter turmoil that has gone into this fight on the left and the right side. Well, what happens after? You see, I've done a show on this before. We actually called the show The Post-Trump World, and it was all about what happens when Trump is no longer in office and all the elements that are in his base and comprise the people that support a guy like him and candidates that are like-minded like him. You kind of wonder what's next. Well, now, sadly, we have to have a whole show of talking about that, but this time, not from the government perspective, but from us, the media, and you, the public. Because, you see, it seems that as time has progressed since the inauguration of one Donald J. Trump, January 20th, 2017, media has, as much as politics, started to show a polarity, as it were. Whereas one side of the news covers only these things, and the other side covers only not those things. Now, in the world of political bias, of course, we have companies like MSNBC and Fox News. One, liberal biased, the other, conservative biased. But does that bias actually exist in other places other than the ones that we already know? And in fact, now we can say, yeah, it does. And it seems like with the way stories are presented, and I know, I'm probably a guilty party in this, so that's why I told all the correspondents, please do not come into the show today. I'm about to take some responsibility for our foolishness when it comes to the media. Because now when you hear headlines, the headlines are always from a specific slant, geared to a specific audience. That audience, of course, being who they know will put eyes on their product consistently, and that they can sell those numbers to the advertisers and make a buck at the end of the day. With all that said and done, look at the actual headline. Look at the actual headlines from the last administration, Barack Obama's time. Then, challenge yourself and look at some of the headlines under George W. Bush's tenure as president. Bill Clinton. And you'll see that something has happened now in media more so than ever before. Media comes at the bias. It doesn't try to cut through it and be as objective as it used to be. No, it seems like, much like the politics in the United States, us in the media have also gone ultra-polarized. And the sad thing is that when you ask any reputable media source, including me, Am I reputable? All right, moving on. Any media source will tell you, no, we are not biased, we are objective. But are we really? Because of the political strain in the United States taking such a polarizing toll on society, well, you, gentle viewer and listener of broadcast news, have kind of changed the way things are done forever. It seems like on one side of the political aisle, if the news isn't all bad about the people that you hate and all good for the people that you like, and of course vice versa on the other, then that source is uncredible. That source is fake. That source is made up. And that's dangerous. The reason why is because a lot of times, even in science, a particular bias can cloud our judgment to costly end. So the last time that we did a show of this nature where we said, what happens in a post-Trump world? Well, we talked about the government. Now we need to talk about us. Because, see, here's the thing. Everybody is kind of expected, and did expect, in fact, Mueller's report to be this big magic wand that would come out and clear up any sort of confusion for people on the right side. The president was innocent. Everything is okay. Yada, yada, yada. Hail Trump, the supreme leader. Oops, we're not supposed to say that part out loud. And now on the other side, the news was supposed to be, Trump is the worst fascist since Mussolini. We should burn Republicans in the street. Ah, rabble, rabble, rabble. You see what I'm saying? The two sides of the coverage don't have any gray area. And we were hoping that when the Mueller report came out, this gray area that we wanted to exist would be somewhere along the truth. You know how they say halfway between fiction and reality lies the truth? Well, in the case of Mueller's investigation and Trump's rhetoric and Giuliani's rhetoric over the weekend and stuff, the thing that you have to remember is that this news industry that we're in will have to deal with a different dynamic, a shift in paradigm, as you were, after Trump is no longer in office. And that could be very, very hard because of what's happened in American society. As more and more people become polarized, and if you don't think people are polarized, post something up political on your social media and then sit back, because it's going to be one hell of a ride. But when we talk about polarization, the absolute belief in absolute rights and absolute wrongs and no nuance, no area for exploration of compromise in between shall exist. When we talk about that kind of mental dynamic that the United States is going through, it impacts everything, including how you are told the stories of the day. You see, if you didn't have a particular slant, you wouldn't look at particular shows. You wouldn't constantly be scanning for news that reinforces your own values versus news that is actually informative in a realistic and objective way. And that's where things got naughty with the president and the media. You see, back when he took office and started attacking the media as the enemy of the people, the media, rightly so, by the way, decided to retaliate and kind of go, no, we are important. We are important. CNN had a whole commercial series about it, you know, apples and oranges and, yeah, it was a fruit stand. When it comes to all of these kind of positioning statements and posturing from the media around that time, it was kind of in a defensive way because they were being called the enemy of the people. Now, keep in mind, Donald Trump isn't the first president to come along and call the media the enemy of the people. However, the last guy that did it, things didn't end up too well for him. And in this whole, ooh, let's rush to the future kind of way, the media predicting that Trump will meet the end that Nixon met, kind of preemptively stacked the deck as far as bias in their headline. Now, I know what you're thinking, but Shaggy, Trump is a pretty bad person. And yeah, to that end, I would have to agree with you. However, as President of the United States and a free and open media, both of those sides should aspire, at least in some sort of semblance that
that would make this a believable thing, media and government should aspire for ultimate transparency. But transparency doesn't serve narrative. You see, narrative depends on some things being elevated in attention and others being diminished. Take, for instance, the case of Donald Trump's attack on the media. The media took it as, oh my God, this is an affront to a free and open press, versus this is somebody that clearly doesn't understand how law works, talking out of turn, and we should really focus on doing our jobs. That's not where the dollars went. Because then you, the American public, started to get really, really angry and lose the ability to compromise and have nuance between the two political ideologies that ruled the day. And as such, all media organizations kind of had to change the way they presented stories because they didn't want you going out on the internet and just finding willy-nilly stories from anybody for free. Yeah, it was all about the client dollars. So in a weird, sick way, the way that the United States media is kind of reacting right now is because of that's how the American public is conditioned to receive things. So when we talk about that post-Trump world that I keep mentioning, media and the general society at large in America is going to have what they call a day of reckoning, the first day after Donald Trump is not in the White House. Now, here's the problem. Change of this scale happens only two ways. One, through some sort of catastrophic upsetting of the system, i.e. Donald Trump and his way of doing things. A disruptive way of doing things comes in very suddenly and very powerfully and shakes up foundations, and it takes years and years, and what we're predicting is about 30 to 40 years, to repair the damage from those things done. But then there's the other, the slow kind of, you build up a steady current of things until one day, much like the straws on the back of a camel, you finally add up enough weight to break, well, whatever resistance that you were trying to. And when it comes to media, White House, and all of this that I'm talking about when it comes to the post-Trump world, the straw that's going to break the camel's back is, at what point do we realize that our political opinions are driving our public perceptions through influencing which news services present what stories and in what context they present them in? I know that seems like, whoa, college-level doctorate thinking, but it's not really. Think about it this way. If you went to a restaurant and they had two, let's say, burgers on the menu, and one of those burgers was the standard American fare, a good old American cheeseburger, lettuce, tomato, onions, a little bit of mayo, some black pepper, and salt to taste, on a bun, right? Just a good old American cheeseburger. No frills about it, but that is the one that is the most popular in city to city across these United States. Okay, that's it. That's the one that everybody expects you to go for. But let's say all of a sudden America develops a hankering for another burger on that same menu, the second one. And maybe this one isn't the standard fare. Maybe this one has something, ooh, exotic, like avocado or something on. The more people gravitate towards that, the more its prominence rises on the menu and the more that that business would push that item because they see a trend, supply and demand. That's kind of how capitalism works, right? So, too, is how you get news presented to you. And when it comes to a post-Trump world, will the American public recover enough of its common sense to go, oh my God, political polarization has divided our nation so much so that we are in gridlock from county level, state level, to federal government level. No parties want to work with each other because we, the American public, have polarized so much. Now, it doesn't matter that the fact that the current administration is the reason for that polarization. They'll be gone in the future, and we will have to pick up the pieces. And when we talk about what happens post-Trump, here's the thing. There's going to have not only a couple of conversations exist between media and the American public where we try to reassure you, oh my God, that was a crazy ride. We're going to get back to doing the job that we do without being so defensive because now we no longer are called enemy of the people. There's going to be that moment, but then there's also going to be that moment where the American public is going to have to decide that once again, we need to work with our fellow person to make things right. And all opinions are thrown up on the table, but at the end of the day, the needs of the many are met sufficiently so that we're reducing the complaints of the few. It's kind of an easy way of buttoning that all up, isn't it? And it would be so much easier thinking in a term of a government that could actually work together. But in the current world that we find ourselves in, we have one branch of the legislature working at the federal level to find anything they can about a corrupt executive who's being backed up by the other branch of the legislature, the Senate, who absolutely refuses to do any sort of oversight or a check on the balance of power between the legislative branch and the office of the presidency. Now, when you think about it like that, it's like, whoa, I think we should actually do something about that because that sounds like an impossible dynamic to exist at a federal government level. It almost sounds like it could be damaging. And in both cases, you would be absolutely correct. But this is you that I'm talking to now that possesses common sense, that's had a little bit of time to kind of analyze how polarized we are and how the media reinforces the polarization that society inflicts on us, and how that polarization was caused by our president and his weird one-sided way of doing things. Knowing all of that now, it makes a lot of sense to you when I say something like, hey, we have a gridlock situation, and this gridlock situation, it will eventually have to be unraveled. And it's going to be up to us to make sure that when it does unravel, the loose ends don't cost somebody an eye. But that's easy for you to understand now. But try this experiment. And I did, and it was rough. Spend 1 hour of watching liberal bias, let me throw up the air quotes here, liberal bias news media, and then air quotes again, conservative bias news media. At the end of the day, it's all story. Now, whether or not those stories are inflated in value depends on the political bias, but spend 1 hour of programming time on each one of those biases. Then come back and try to tell me in a realistic way what happened in today's news. You're going to find that one part of the story omitted facts because it made their argument look bad, and the other part of the story may have, sad but true, just invented an emphasis on something that did not exist to begin with. It's like that way that 11 o'clock news always scares you about trends with your teenagers, knowing that no teenager in their right mind would do some of the stupid stuff that us adults get on the late night news and tell other parents, you should be worried about this. Kids are now sniffing sheep fleas. Or whatever. They do it for rating. They do it to get you in kind of an anxiety mindset so that you have to pay attention to that content. However, at the end of the day, where does that leave everyone? A little bit more afraid, a little bit more shaky, and definitely uncertain of everyone around them. And trust in media, and media regaining the trust of the public, is absolutely essential in a post-Trump world. Because as it stands, Donald Trump has officially, well, unofficially, as close as possible, married his administration to Fox News and conservative-only media. Even going into right-wing and conspiratorial meeting because let's not forget, a lot of the early interviews with Donald Trump as a candidate happened with Alex Jones on a network called InfoWars. Not exactly credible or reputable journalism. Think about it. The guy is getting sued for making up a Sandy Hook conspiracy theory. Now, with that said, here's the problem. When Trump leaves office, the media is going to have to change its dynamic of function. It's going to have to, once again, and it's and I go ahead and admit a simple truth. It's why we follow foreign press on this show more so than domestic press. We go to places like Germany, to places like Canada, to, yeah, even foreign language sites. Like Germany, well, I already said Germany, but like Australia and Singapore and China. And the reason that we have to go to foreign press on this show is because that's the only way that we can get headlines that are presented in such a way that we can, yay, put our own little entertainment spin on. Yes, you heard me correct. Parts of this show, including the snark and sarcasm, are for entertainment purposes possible. Because I am like a journalistic Mary Poppins? Yeah. Or maybe a journalistic Yondu. Point being is that when it comes to the media, to put my own little spoonful of sugar on it to make some of these hard stories go down, I have to rely on finding the actual story. Not to find a summation of what happened and an opinion of what that means, or to find a biased depiction of that story through whatever political lens I happen to be looking through, and only getting the part that makes it objective that I support the line of thinking of that author. They're conservative, you think conservative, liberal, you get the point. So when it comes to where we go after this, media is going to have a very hard time because it doesn't function like foreign media. Foreign media takes a look at the United States and goes, oh, we don't know what they're up to, but here's what happened. So here's the thing. When we talk to, well, our listeners on this show, when we talk amongst our the correspondents and everything, there's always this general sense of, man, I'll be glad when this is over. I'll be glad when this is over. But can I go ahead and throw out a sad truth? Neither Washington, the government, nor media, the nation, have an effective plan for what happens next. We have been gridlocked in this way of doing things for so long that as soon as the next thing happens, whether that be a step into full-blown fascism or democratic socialism or just, you know, regular old American life as we once knew it and loved, no matter which direction we step into, the problem with the post-Trump predictions right now is we're all going to wake up in a world that, at least as American citizens, we do not understand. And much like this show, where it goes out to foreign press to actually get the juice of the stories that are happening domestically, the United States is going to have to kind of repair a lot of those domestically damaging things that Trump did during his administration to get the rest of the world to, one, here's the sad fact, catch us up to speed with the way the rest of the world has progressed over the last couple of years, and two, help repair the damage within our own policies here and how that could affect them, wherever them are, wherever they are. In a post-Trump world right now, though, nobody has an exit strategy, and it's time that we start thinking of it. And because I'm a member of the media, can I go ahead and tell you, there's probably a very, very, very good chance that we're not going to figure it out first. Instead, it's just like that good old sales tip that they tell you in the sales office of every media empire. You have to go with what the market will bear and what the demand needs. And with that said, you, gentle listener, are going to have to decide, after Trump leaves office, to be less politically inclined in every conversation you have. To be less polarized in your own beliefs and political ideology and be open for discussion. To allow compromise to take precedence over just hashtag winning all the time. Now, I know that these so far don't sound like too hard of things to accomplish, right? But keep in mind who we're asking. Everyone, all at once, to do this. Because in the post-Trump world that we're setting up now, the media will not go back to being responsible for a while. And that's because the listening public, the buying public, well, they have no interest in it. And until we all get interested in finding the center, finding the balance between the ideologies that people pound day after day after day into our skull, and only my way is right, and only my way is right, when that talk ceases, well, that's when we're going to be able to heal as a nation. Because in a post-Trump world, I hate to say it, we are going to need Republicans. And Republicans, they're going to need us. It's nothing that anybody wants to admit out loud because everybody's so angry and so polarized that we want to put our hands up under our armpits and stomp our feet and say there's no way that this is going to happen. Well, I hate to tell you this, but it has to happen. And unfortunately, the longer that we go at the way that we're going and with the trends that we've got going on, the more that happens, the less likely we are to find sanity in a post-Trump world. So think about it. It's not just government's responsibility or media's responsibility. It's yours. And we're going to need your help. Coming up, we'll talk more about the latest findings from D.C. and Trump's weird weekend. The Shaggy Jenkins Show.
This is Scientific American's 60 Second Science. I'm Adam Levy. Water molecules can arrange themselves to form much larger structures. Take intricate snowflakes, which form all by themselves in the right conditions. Well, now researchers have created some delicate water structures of their own in the form of microscopic ice mazes, with a little help from light. The team took some sugar water and kept it at a temperature where ice crystals and water happily coexist. They then exposed the H2O to infrared light of a frequency that is absorbed much more easily by the ice crystals than it is by the water.
We thought that something interesting will happen when you illuminate ice which absorbs more than water, because once the ice is melting, then it's become liquid water, and then it's absorbed less. So you have kind of a negative feedback situation, and we did not know what will happen with this.
Physicist Ido Breslovsky from the Hebrew University in Jerusalem. The heating caused by the light melted tiny holes in the crystals. These holes sometimes joined up to form channels, and the researchers watched as a labyrinth-like pattern gradually formed over the course of an hour.
And at some point, we suddenly saw a whole spectrum of patterns that appear. There were holes that open and close. There were channels that was appearing. And altogether, we realized that we found a new phenomena which was not observed before.
The researchers have published their findings in the journal Science Advances. And cool as all this may sound, there may also be some icy applications for this technique. Defrosting may make you think of microwave ovens, but heating ice with microwaves has some drawbacks.
The microwave actually warms the water, but not the ice. So here we have a system which we warm the ice even more than the water.
And because the shorter wavelength infrared light warms the ice more than the water, the technique could come in handy for carefully unfreezing delicate biological samples that have been kept on ice, which would be a good thing to see and to have thaw. Thanks for listening. For Scientific American's 60 Second Science, I'm Adam Levy.
Dig deeper. Remove the hype. Find the facts. It's the Shaggy Jenkins Show on the Pacifica Radio Network.
It's the Shaggy Jenkins Show on the Pacifica Radio Network. Welcome back. If you missed any part of the first part of the show, remember, you can always catch up with us on our website, that I badly need to update at ShaggyChickens.com or wherever fine social media is served at Shaggy Live. Plus, you can subscribe to us on services like Stitcher, Spotify, iTunes. Hell, you can even find me on Patreon. Just look for The Shaggy Jenkins Show. Welcome back, everybody. I'm, of course, that guy whose name I said about half a dozen times. And I wanted to bring up another story about healing of the nation, because in a post-Trump world, stories like our next one probably wouldn't have as much, one, meat, and two, so much to unpack. You see, as far as the American civilization that we were advancing to prior to Trump's election, we were pretty much becoming a lot more tolerant, a lot more open and accepting. But since Donald Trump took over office, we've seen a rise in hate crimes, specifically crimes that are racially motivated and crimes against homosexuals and transgenders. Now, those have been just a few of the areas that crime has increased, where we thought that we had kind of had a grip on these social issues. But one candidate is kind of reminding everybody the source of all of it. And here's the thing. The next couple of comments that I am going to make, if you are a person that does have some sort of religious orthodoxy or follows a theological practice, please understand that I am not trying to offend you. I am trying to point out the short-sightedness of the way that things have happened as of late. Now, Donald Trump enjoys a, and this is very strange but very true, a very steadfast support base within the evangelical wing of the Republican Party. Now, with that said, they have kind of, the evangelicals, the radicals, within the Christian faiths of America, has adopted Donald Trump as the second coming of Christ, sometimes almost literally that. Now, I'm not saying almost literally that as a way of going, literally, it was as big as my face. It wasn't as big as your face. It was just a large donut. No, in this case, I mean almost literally. That's how close we came, because the political ideology in the United States now goes, Trump, Trump, he's our man. He's the one with God's plan. And that's the only thing that certain evangelicals come for. And as such, they have gravitated to Donald Trump and said, he's going to be the ones that defend things like family values and all that. Okay. One, who gave anybody the right to determine what makes a family? Besides blood relation and things that are, you know, linked to core genetic biology, who gave anyone the right to determine who could and could not have a family? Because that's a hard question to really ask. And when it comes to this conservative base within the evangelical population of the United States and their steadfast support of Donald Trump, the biggest cheerleader that they have had on the board from day one has been Mike Pence, who not only talks about being a very religious person, a person that believes in Christian values, can't be left alone in a room with a woman without his wife present, doesn't like gay people, believes in conversion therapy, and actually, this is sad but true, wanted to author a bill that would have allowed for federal funding of gay conversion therapy. Practice which has been said to be draconian at best and absolutely ineffective. When it comes to that guy, though, Pence has also taken the other side of turning the faithful to the Christian faith into the faithful of Donald Trump. You'll remember very vividly, I'm sure, especially if you're a longtime listener of this show, that when Donald Trump started to hold press conferences, there was this weird moment at the end of it where Mike Pence would get up there and sing the president's praises. I'd like to thank you, President Trump, for allowing us to be here today to make these decisions for the American people. And I'd like to thank you, Donald Trump, for the things that you have done. Like, he would literally praise Donald Trump in almost an idolizing kind of way. You know, that thing that's actually against one of the principal tenets of Christianity, thou shalt have no God before me.
But Mike Pence started to set up this dynamic of Trump being godlike to conservatives. And it caught on. And it caught on in a very bad way. Because now, some 2.5 years later, after a public introduction into this whole guy's weird way of thinking, conservative Christians are more likely to see Donald Trump as a man beyond reproach versus a human that has made some very human mistakes and continues to make judgment that could harm other humans because, cannot stress this any more loudly or subtly, actually, it's just got to be expressed as it is. Donald Trump is not a product of Christianity. Never was, never will. And abides into the tenets for as long as they guarantee his popularity, but when asked for his favorite verse, he couldn't even produce one. Even me, a staunch atheist, can tell you at least half a dozen Bible verses. So already we've got kind of this weird dynamic between the faithful of Christianity becoming the faithful for Donald Trump. And one guy has kind of been the major disruptor as of late in this whole ideological love of Donald Trump. And that would be Pete Buttigieg. Buttigieg. I'll say his name properly better because chances are if he keeps up what he's doing, he's going to be around for a while. Now, if you've heard of Pete Buttigieg, you probably know that he is from South Bend. He's a mayor. He's married. He's openly gay. These are probably things that you know about him. But one thing that a lot of the media isn't playing up is Buttigieg's faith. Okay, Buttigieg's faith is very simply an adherence to Christian ideology. Now, considering that Mike Pence prizes his knowledge of biblical stuff. I mean, he literally holds himself up as some sort of biblical scholar of being a staunch adherent to the Judeo-Christian faith. Isn't it kind of odd that some of the basic tenets of Christianity are now being challenged by an openly gay man who used to serve under Mike Pence in Indiana? The latest comments that he made, and this is Buttigieg, at a speech at the LGBTQ Victory Fund National Champagne Brunch in Washington, D.C., which, by the way, if you've never had a champagne brunch, girl, you do not know what you missed. You better get on that. But here's the thing. Buttigieg basically said this. Marrying his husband taught him to be a more godly person. It made him a better human being. And as somebody that's married myself, I can tell you, yeah, when I met my wife and married her, I indeed became a better human. And isn't that what we want for everybody at the end of the day? No matter what our faith or background, we just want to make better human. But Pete went on and said, my marriage to Chasen has made me a much better man. And yes, Mr. Vice President, it has moved me closer to God. See, that's where it started. Let's not forget, and I remind you every chance I get, this is the same guy that at South by Southwest was absolutely on nobody's radar until he got up there and said, I wonder when Pence stopped praising Jesus and started praising Trump. Everybody kind of took a whoa pause moment. Because, kind of true. But here's the thing. Now, after that opening salvo, you would figure that all of his ammo was used up, but no. Speaking at this conference, he went on to say, quote, I can tell you that if me being gay was a choice, it was a choice that was made far, far above my pay grade. And that's the thing I wish the Mike Pences of the world could understand. That if you have a problem with who I am, your problem is not with me. Your quarrel, sir, is with my creator. And that's one of the things that really flies in the face of this viral support of the president and the evangelical side of the conservative party. certain principles that were more New Testament principles than Old Testament principles basically said, treat everyone as equal, love your neighbor, don't covet, don't steal, don't kill, follow the laws of the land, pay your taxes, be good people. Oh, and then there's a four-headed beast coming out of them. Yeah, well, that's the New Testament stuff. And being a devout Episcopalian, like Pete is, these are values that are taught in his faith. Now, Pence, on the conservative Christian side, has always been staunchly against same-sex marriage, has said that it is a plague upon humanity, that gay people shouldn't be allowed to adopt, that there should be conversion therapy for those that are gay because God did not intend for them to be gay. In other words, Mike Pence is going against the will of the Creator. And you don't really think of that if you're ensconced in the Christian faith. You don't think to question somebody's devoutness through their actions, and do they actually adhere to the values, or in this case, the value system of the Christian faith. And when it comes to all those New Testament things that you were taught, it indeed seems more like Pete's the right man than Pence. Now, here's the thing. Whenever we talk about subjects like this, we do get a certain amount of mail. And if you want to send any email to us, hate, like, or otherwise, shaggyjenkins@gmail.com. Of course, I keep my email up on the website, and that's why from time to time when I do stories like this, I get a little bit of, you don't understand anything about Christian faith, and you don't understand any. I kind of do. It's kind of something I've studied. But even me, somebody that likes to have that open-mind skepticism that makes us all so annoying to theological adherents, this is the thing with Pete's logic. Buttigieg has basically came out and said, hey, remember that thing that you're saying that you are? Well, if you adhere to the values of Mike Pence, you are not actually following the faith. And besides causing a little bit of a political turmoil, statements like this are causing ripples of thought across the United States with making us reanalyze what is what when it comes to homosexuality and spirituality. And if you want any indication of how things are going in that realm, look no further than a story that came out last week where the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, we can't call them the Mormons anymore, made a decision to drop all of their bad, bad doctrines against the LGBTQ community and to even hold baptisms for children of same-sex couples. So if you want to know where the actual national trends are going, look no further than that story. But Mike Pence would have you believe that somewhere in America, there's a bunch of Americans hunkered down in their basements, crucifixes in hand, clutching their Bibles, fear of Sharia law beating down their door at any second in their heads, and these people are just so, so oppressed. And they're so marginalized, and we have to help them so much, but those people are the minority of the faith. And when it comes to this conversation that's now happening with this Democratic candidate that, let's just be honest, for all intents and purposes, nobody saw him getting any headlines past, hey, my name's Pete. With all of this stuff swirling around and the ways that he's systematically going after the tenets of support that has kept Trump in power, it makes you wonder if the rest of the Democratic field has caught on to it. Because as long as the faithful are allowed to extend Trump through Mike Pence's sycophanting, extend Trump this whole guise of being holy, of being empowered by God himself to be in office in the position that he's in, they will overlook things like his criminality, his adultery, his lies, and all of the other stuff that comprise the seven deadly sins. Yes, even gluttony. But that's the problem. Faithful people take faith at face value, and as such, even though Trump does these despicable things in public record, they are more adherent to the Bible verses that say, well, I'm not going to go all preachy on you. I'll just tell you that there's certain parts in the Bible that says the message of the Lord can come from anywhere. So they're willing to overlook all of the injustice that he creates just to feel a little sense of justice for their own niche viewpoints of how the world should work. A world that is rapidly changing and progressing around them. And nothing has like caused as much dust kicking in the last week as the former Lieutenant Governor Peter Buttigieg and Mike Pence having this ideological debate in the public eye. Because it's going to help define who we are as an America in a post-Trump world. And that's something that we all kind of need to think about. All right, before we get out of here, I want to get this one last story squeezed in because this one's kind of severe. Now, over the weekend, we saw the ousting of Department of Homeland Security's Kristen Nielsen, a woman that wasn't racist or tough enough for Donald Trump. Now, here's something kind of crazy. Donald Trump is basically after all departments he can get his hands on. And in his latest ousting, he is now ousting the United States Secret Service Director. Now, Randolph Ailes, he's one of the people in the Department of Homeland Security. He's getting ousted as of, well, yesterday. And this is the thing. Since dozens of officials have emptied the Trump White House since 2017, everybody's always had kind of a question of, did they leave willingly or were they coerced or were they just basically told, don't show up for work? That's what happened to Omarosa. And it wasn't nice, John Kelly. We still remember that. Getting back to the whole point of this story, here's the thing. Trump getting rid of Nielsen as the leader of the Department of Homeland Security was just a small stop in his path of reshaping every single person that can issue some sort of control over him. So this is what's so weird. Where the hell does the Secret Service come in with all of this? Well, here's the thing. Not too long ago, the president who enjoys constant protection by the Secret Service was actually kind of admitted to be in a room alone without his Secret Service detail, only a translator for 45 minutes with a leader that he is suspected of at the time allegedly rigging the 2016 election. Now, as the members of the Secret Service are kind of, well, they're their own agency. They're one of the people that can kind of either press the president for adherence to their rules or even report any activity that they see kind of weird. And isn't it kind of funny now that with all these subpoenas going into what activity Trump has engaged in and when he's engaged in it, all of a sudden, Trump not only ousted his Department of Homeland Security, but also the head of the Secret Service, the one agency that has almost unabated access to the president himself. And a lot of people say that all these changes are being made because, in Trump's mind, his immigration policies aren't being enforced fast enough. And with yesterday's decision of a California court striking down Trump's once again need to make people wait in Mexico for their asylum claims, Trump has been looking for a way to speed up his anti-immigrant agenda. Now, I've also covered it on this show before. We're not really sure whose agenda it is. It could be even Stephen Miller. Because when you're talking about the face of, right now, American first, it's not Donald Trump. Those words may come out of his mouth a lot, but nowhere do they adhere back to their 1920s value of being members of the Ku Klux Klan, so much so as when they come out of the mouth of Stephen Miller. Stephen Miller has been basically doing racist and rotten things his whole adult life, and some would even challenge that that went back into his teenage years. But when it comes to this latest firing of the director of Secret Service, was it at the behest of Donald Trump? Was this a resignation? Or was this another one of Stephen Miller's moves? Now, when you talk about Stephen Miller making moves, as of late, he's had a lot of moves made behind the scene, including helping to stack with Jeff Sessions as the Attorney General, helping to stack immigration courts against asylum seekers, not only downplaying the role of asylum honoring in the United States Border Patrols, but putting up, I guess you could say, red tape and roadblocks between the naturalization process as it has always existed. In his strong anti-immigration stance, Stephen Miller has sought to reshape Washington through the backdoor channels of the Trump administration. And when you look at everybody that was involved with the early discussions of the Trump campaign, later the Trump presidency, when it dealt with naturalization, immigration, the role of immigration in American economy, and of course, safety, 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 count the people in the picture, only one is left. And it's Stephen Miller. So this is the thing. When it came to the president going after Nielsen and accusing her of not being tough enough, was those Donald Trump's words? We don't know. When it comes to Mr. Ailes, being ejected the day after Ms. Nielsen, do we have a line of sight that says this decision definitely came from the president or definitely was a machination of Stephen Miller? No, we don't. But when you look at some of these moves that are happening, here's something that is kind of scaring a lot of people. Is this a slow motion political coup? I know those words sound like, oh my God, he's talking about an overthrow of the... Okay. Remember, this is still America. There's still a lot of checks and balances that we could be doing. But when I talk about coup in this sense, is Donald Trump, for the first time ever, seeking to stack all of the federal branches that are associated with the presidency with loyalists or with people qualified for the job? Because it looks like for the first time in the history of the White House, loyalty matters in every single connected foundation. If you're in the intelligence community, you need to be loyal to the president first and the investigative process and truth somewhere down the line after that. If you're members of the border protection and immigration enforcement, you need to basically listen to the whims of the president, not so much what the mandate of the law that has been hashed out decade after decade here in the United States and probably way more competent in real-world issues dealing. Yeah, you shouldn't trust that either. When it comes to these oustings of all of these people around the president right now, should you trust the motivations? And can you trust that these moves are happening under Donald Trump's behest? That, sadly, the question that I can't answer. Now, even though the head of the Secret Service was asked to leave about 11 days ago, even though he was asked to go, here's the problem with that. The news didn't really become public until the beginning of this week. And when you start to have clandestine moves made like that, you need to start watching the agenda of people making calls. Because when it comes to Donald Trump, let me go ahead and say this, he's not the guy pulling all the strings on this puppet show. And as such, we kind of have to take a deep breath and realize the puppet strings go much higher. Somewhere in the shadows, a man that is honestly about 6 years younger than me in age and about 70 years older than me in appearance, Stephen Miller, that's where you're going to find the real puppet master. But this Secret Service thing is really suspect because as much as I tried to find out what role possibly could the Secret Service have in obstructing the president's agenda, obstructing this whole anti-immigration thing, this this whole white supremacy thing that they've got going on in D.C., when I started to look at all of the things that the Secret Service could do and would be involved in, it's scary because they're the ones that have to talk about security vulnerabilities around the president, actual security concerns about people in the president's staff, and yeah, they're the ones that are with the president all the time, listening to every word that comes out of his mouth. So Donald Trump, in his way of once again trying to insulate himself from trouble, trying to keep himself out of the muck, has fired another department head. Will that be the only head that rolls this week? I'm just going to throw it out there. Probably not. Probably not. Well, thanks for joining the show. Remember, you can keep up with us at our website, ShaggyJenkins.com. Join me for another one tomorrow, where hopefully I'll have better English. Till then, love you, mean it. Gate in, bye.